Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we talk with former Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Brian Mulroney. Some background for listeners. Mr. Mulroney was born in Baie-Comeau, Quebec. Maurice Duplessis was Quebec Premier and Mackenzie King was Prime Minister. A graduate of Saint-Évêque and Université de Montréal, Mr. Mulroney practiced law in Montreal. After winning the Progressive Conservative Party leadership in 1983, he led the party to victory in 1984 and then again in 1988. He stepped down in 1993 and returned to the practice of law. As Prime Minister, his policies were actively internationalist through trade agreements, notably the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement and the NAFTA, and in multilateral forum like the G7, UN, Francophonie, Organization for American States, APEC, and the Commonwealth. His government led famine relief in Ethiopia. His opposition to apartheid in South Africa pitted him against fellow conservatives Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. But as he would say time and again, you can disagree without being disagreeable. Important nuance. And without his close relationship with Ronald Reagan, it is doubtful we'd have achieved the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement or American acknowledgement, if not acceptance, of Canadian sovereignty in the Arctic. His work and that of his foreign minister, Joe Clark, was essential in helping bring about German reunification. Former Green leader Elizabeth May has proclaimed Mr. Mulroney to be Canada's greenest prime minister for his early work on climate and his tireless efforts to secure, successfully, the Acid Rain Accord. After discussions with Mr. Mulroney, President George H.W. Bush sought and achieved UN sanction to push the Iraqis out of Kuwait. Mr. Mulroney ushered Canada into APEC and the Organization of American States and helped create La Francophonie, hosting its second summit in Quebec City. He hosted the G7 leaders in Toronto. He directed a successful bid and then our term on the UN Security Council in 1989 and 1990. In 2007, Mr. Mulroney published his memoirs covering his early life and 9 years as Prime Minister. Mr. Mulroney, welcome to Global Exchange.
Thank you, Colin. Happy to be with you.
Let's begin with your sense of our world situation. Pandemic, America first, a rising China, a revanchist Russia, shifting attention to the Indo-Pacific with Korea, Taiwan, Indo-Pakistan, India, China, Afghanistan, Iran, continuing turmoil in the Middle East. I guess my question to you, is the world messier and meaner than usual, or is its complexity and confusion just the way it is?
No, I think it is messier than usual, but times have changed. You know, that was then and now is now. We lived in we thought it was pretty terrific or horrific, the circumstances of the Cold War with nuclear missiles pointed at Washington and New York and London and so on. But now we're dealing with, but at least that was visible. We knew and we had countermeasures for it all. But now we are struggling with this pandemic and an extremely unsettled international scene. And without, if I may say, the strong internationalist leadership from America that, in my case, I was privileged to work with President Reagan and President Bush and President Clinton, who were all in that mold. Now it's different. The internationalism has given way to protectionism and unilateralism. And so this makes solutions to our complex problems even more difficult, because without strong American leadership, it's difficult to see how these matters can be ultimately and fairly resolved.
And without American leadership, what do countries like Canada do? Because as you say, we've been, a reliable and loyal ally, but part of a collective alliance. We're not the only ones that are kind of finding it difficult without American leadership. I think that the French, the Germans, to an extent the British, others do the same way. What do we do?
Well, I think, for example, in Canada's position, we should begin by paying our bills. You know, we're delinquent at the United Nations. We're delinquent with NATO. And, you know, President Trump was right when he insisted that countries begin by meeting their 2% obligation, 2% of GDP obligations to NATO. He was right in that. But, for example, his most recent initiative into international affairs, which involved Germany, when he abruptly decided he was going to withdraw half of the contingent, the American contingent there, I think it's in the neighborhood of 52,000 or some significant portion thereof, remove them from Germany, an indication that this was a way to punish Germany or for not attending the G7 meeting. But that's wrong. The American troops are not there to protect Germany. They're to protect the Transatlantic Alliance against Russia. That's why they're there. This is part of the NATO defense. And so this kind of impulsive action by the Americans these days is difficult to understand, but we're just going to have to muddle through until it's all sorted out in an election. Either Mr. Trump is reelected or Mr. Biden comes in, and then begin a new process of working with them. Because the Americans are there. Mr. Trump didn't come in a secret door at night. He was elected by the American people. And so that we have to respect and we have to try and work with. It's been a challenge, but we'll see what happens after the election. But it is vital that Canada, no matter what, rebuild its relationship with the United States of America.
And that is, as you've said, I think quite correctly, the primordial relationship for Canada. I think, as you've put it, you know, the one relationship that every prime minister has to get right is that with the President of the United States, as difficult as that may be, certainly under current circumstances.
Well, you know, there are 198 nations in the world, I think, now, and all of them trying to get in to see the President of the United States or his highest advisors and so on. And Canada used to have an open door when I was there. We have an open door policy, come and go as we almost pleased. Regular conversations with the president about not only bilateral matters, but consultations on international matters and so on. So we were in a pretty privileged position, and that seems to have disappeared. Now, in fairness, Prime Minister Trudeau has a much more difficult job than I had in this area. Because, as I say, President Reagan, President Bush, and President Clinton, with whom I worked, were all committed internationalists. They had a strong affection for Canada and a respect for our contribution over 150 years to the well-being of the alliance, but also to the well-being of mankind. They saw things pretty well the same way. Mr. Trudeau has a difficult challenge now because the Trump administration, you know, are more protectionist, more unilateralist, and less inclined to work closely with allies. Now, that's a political choice they made. I'm not quarreling with the American choice, but it certainly makes Mr. Trudeau's job much more difficult than mine.
No, that's certainly the case, as you say, the kind of departure. Now, one of the, and I cited it in the kind of introduction, it's a great phrase that I think it's a good way for leaders to live, is as you say, you can disagree without being disagreeable. And but there must have been times when you dealt with either American presidents, and certainly Margaret Thatcher talks in her memoir that she'd had several frank conversations about you with Ronald Reagan, but she also says, end of the day, you know, she had a lot of, yours was a respectful and a trustful relationship. How did you manage those relationships? Because that you had lots of them with different leaders, not just Americans and Brits, but with Africans, with Asians,
yeah,
Latin Americans.
Well, for example, In the years I was with President Reagan, the matter closest to his heart was SDI. And
right.
I decided this was not in Canada's national interest at the time. And so rather than make a speech about it or attack the Americans, as a lot of people were doing, I called him early on a Saturday morning and told him I was going to put this to cabinet and caucus, that we were disinclined to participate, but we would certainly acknowledge his right to do so. And he said, well, Brian, this is very disappointing to me, but, you know, I'm very glad that you called me privately to let me know your concerns, and we'll just continue on a good relationship. So there are ways to do things. We opposed his position on Central America, his position on apartheid, many other things, but we always did it, I always did it in a way that was respectful of the fact that he had been elected president by the American people, that he had a country to run, and he had he was entitled to his own policies, but that didn't mean that Canada didn't have its own national interest to assert, and I asserted it at all times. And there were some tough moments, but if it's done in a respectful manner, you don't damage the relationship irreparably. And that's what happened.
And I think you've also underlined something which you really were a master, and that was the personal calls. As you say, you picked up the telephone, you talked to Ronald Reagan, and I know you had conversations with George Bush and other presidents. My impression was that you devoted a fair bit of attention to the international relationships, but they were personal, that you did pick up that call. You didn't necessarily wait for them to call you. You phoned them. And as you said, if you disagreed, let them know up front, which certainly my experience with the United States is they don't care if you disagree, but just be up front with them.
Yeah, that's right. And I tried to do that with our major partners around the world, with Margaret Thatcher and Helmut Kohl, François Mitterrand, Nakasone. You know, I was people point to the fact that I was one of only two prime ministers in Canadian history, invited to speak to the Senate and House of Representatives in a joint session. But I was also the first one to be invited to speak to the Japanese Diet as a result of Nakasone's intervention with Parliament to cause me to be invited. But that's because Nakasone and I were on the phone regularly. I'd see him at G7 meetings and other and bilateral meetings, but we kept on the phone talking about his problems and mine and what can we do together. And I always tried to keep Canada in the forefront of the thinking of for example, all the G7 partners, because we were the smallest one, the one with the smallest economy in the G7. So it is important that if we're going to play an important role, that it be built on something other than numbers, because our numbers were fairly weak. So it had to be built on personal relationships, and that's what I worked at.
And having ideas, and the fact that I think certainly with French presidents, of course, you could speak French, which is quite important. And so that kind of linchpin role that Canada plays, you personally played, is and as you point out, we are one of the smaller members in the G7, I guess probably the smallest economy, what's wrong with Italy. But we play a role if you've got ideas and relationships. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You can play a more prominent and powerful role than the numbers would indicate because, you know, as a result of this, you know, there are the bilateral things that we did with the Americans, which were very important, you know. But as a result of this, you know, Canada, I was selected to be co-chairman of the United Nations Summit on Children. Well, not only was that an honor for Canada, and we were, of course, elected easily, as you pointed out, I think we had the largest majority ever of being elected to the Security Council of the United Nations. But as it happened, because we had the summit in the early autumn of, I think, 1990, that it was right in the middle of the preparations for the Gulf War. So we were able, President Bush and I, because we worked very, very closely together on that, were able to see all of the members of the key players, the Arab states who were going to join us, and with Yves Fortier as our ambassador to the United Nations, who was on the Security Council at the time, it all worked together. And to the point where our position, you see, people talk about Mr. Kretzian's position in the war, the Iraq war. But actually, I think his position was the same as mine. I said to Bush, President Bush, many times, George, we're going to be with you 100%, provided you get a resolution through the Security Council of the United Nations. You can't go off in the Wild West here. Canada is a country that is wedded to the United Nations, and you have to get one from the Security Council. Well, we were able to do that. We got it from the Security Council, and that's why Canada participated in 1990. Now, I think Mr. Kretzian said the same thing, but as it turned out, they couldn't get the approval of the Security Council, so he declined to participate. But he was essentially
I think that's exactly right. I agree, and there's a good documentary out in French called High Wire that talks about that, and I think they allude to, they make reference to what you had did, as you say, back in 1990. And I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, so there's a consistency in Canadian foreign policy in respect of the United Nations and our role in the world.
And another thing that struck me about is that you used your foreign service, and you had, I think, again, mentioned Paul Heinbecker, but also Derek Burney, Mark Lortie. You had a number of people who you used the foreign service, and that's not always been the case. It worked for you. Is that fair to say?
Very much so. I thought that the Canadian public service was world class, and I used as prime minister, whenever I needed somebody in the prime minister's office or on my senior staff, I didn't hesitate to call upon foreign policy experts or people in external affairs at the time to join my staff from, you know, as you say, Derek Burney and Marc Lortie and Mark, who went to Cuba as my ambassador.
Mark Entwistle, right.
Mark Entwistle and Bob Grauer and Paul Heinbecker. These were all outstanding people, great minds, and who helped me a lot, made it possible for us to... you know, a prime minister who alienates the public service or doesn't understand how important it is to work with them, somebody who does that is not going to achieve very, very much on the international scene or even nationally. And, you know, incrementalism is what it is. It produces increments. Bold leadership produces nations.
Well, I will just tell listeners that I'll never forget, I had just arrived in Los Angeles as our consul general, and you came down in February to give the Lincoln speech, and you put me right beside you because it was the elite of Los Angeles that came to this event. I think it was at the Wilshire Hotel, and you were extremely kind in making introductions to me, people who during the next 4 years were great contacts, but I owe it all to those very kind introductions you made right at the outset. So thank you on behalf of someone who served in the Foreign Service, because you understood the importance of those relationships.
Well, as Henry Kissinger once said, Colin, in this case, it had the added advantage of being true.
I
remember the dinner well, and it was loaded up with everybody in California. You got off
former
to a great
Secretary
start
of State Warren Christopher. I did, and again, those I say, I thank you, because introductions served me extremely well. Because as you put it all, it's all about your sense, your contacts. Well, look, you've also spent time in China. I want to ask you, what's your sense of what Xi Jinping's trying to do? The West, I think we're starting to increasingly see China as sort of strategic adversary, and since the recent U.S. Defense Department put it, systemic rival. Are we doomed, in the best case, to a new version of peaceful coexistence, or can we actually work something out?
Well, I had dinner some time ago with a very influential old China hand, and he said to me, almost casually, he said, "Prime Minister, I've just returned from China, and believe me, it's no longer the China that you and I once knew. And there has been a dramatic shift in attitude and ambition. All you have to do is look at the attitudes of China vis-a-vis the South China Sea and what they're doing there to their immediate neighbors, and their attitude towards their minorities, and their piling on to Canada, imprisoning two of our innocent citizens for no reason other than the fact that we respected an extradition treaty with the United States of America and caused that to go to court. So this is belligerence of the highest order and throwing their weight around. And we are going to have to, as David Mulroney, no relation, David Mulroney, who was a superb ambassador to China for Canada, has said, we're going to have to sit down and have a complete rethink of where we go from here with China. The only answer that I can see is an enhanced multilateralism. We have to deal with this together, not just alone, but we have to deal with it together with the United States have got to come not on a unilateral basis dealing with China or a bilateral basis with China. They've got to become again the leader of the Western alliance in directly dealing with China, providing leadership for a direct approach to China on a new basis. So Canada has got a role to play, but you know, we're small potatoes in some ways economically with the giants of the world, but we have a good past, a good tradition with China. We've been good to them, and they've until recently been all right with us. But my old friend said, this is not the China, no longer the China that you and I once knew.
Now, you came to Hong Kong when I was there, and as you may remember, among other things, we placed a totem pole in Kowloon Garden.
Yes, indeed.
We spoke out about the importance of representative government. We've got
I was following you around the world, Colin. As you moved, I came.
Well, whenever you came, it put us on the map in a big way. And as you know, from a Foreign Service perspective, a visit of Prime Minister allows you to push the envelope and get things done. And that's what happened. I think we, as a consequence of that visit, we were able to do an air agreement with Hong Kong, one of their first. And again, it was putting meat onto that bones of, and you'd spoken again about representative government. Now, we've got a lot of Canadians potentially there, at least 300,000 passport holders. What could we do for Hong Kong, or are we doing enough? Or it's a difficult situation to say it's part of China, but I know that you've visited it and you understand the Hong Kong situation.
It's a unique situation, and I know that the United Kingdom, for example, is acknowledging that it may. I think there are 3 million Hong Kongers eligible for British citizenship, and we have about 300,000, I think, there. And so we are going to have to be very forthcoming in respect of admitting people who wish now to come to Canada. We're going to have to do that. But we're also going to have to be part of a common front with the Europeans, with the Americans, and the Southeast Asians in dealing with China. Their conduct is unacceptable in the world of today, and in many ways, not always, but in many ways. And we've got to be part of a common front, and we should be taking action to ignite that common front so that the Canadian view and the Canadian position on this is understood and accepted, as even though it could be under American or perhaps European leadership, we'll be in there fighting the good fight.
It's playing that kind of helpful fixer role that
absolutely
personified and that we do well.
It's amazing. You know, President Reagan used to say, I remember him telling me, Brian, you know, it's amazing what you can accomplish if you don't mind who gets the credit. Well, that partly defines Canada's role. Because it's very infrequent, for example, that Canada is able to take like the leadership role in an international crisis as we did against apartheid and for Mandela in South Africa. That's very unusual. Most times, we are along as a helpful, willing partner, helping the larger group make a strong point in international affairs or change the course of history together. But occasionally we can strike out on our own. And I wouldn't hesitate at all to strongly recommend to the government of Canada that they consider doing that along with the Americans in China. We've got great, hell, we were there. Our diplomatic relationships began before Nixon, his opening to China. We were there before, thanks to Pierre Trudeau's government. So we've got a great relationship over the years, and we got to make it known and take advantage of it by insisting upon the Chinese and others, look, this is our tradition, this is our history, look what we've done together. And the only one that can do that is the Prime Minister.
And ultimately, as you say, picking up the phone, you talked about Nelson Mandela in South Africa. You devoted a fair bit of attention to Africa. I talked about famine relief.
Yeah.
Is that relationship with Africa as strong as it was, and are we doing enough for Africa?
Well, I was disappointed when the Harper government apparently shifted a lot of aid from Africa to Latin America, and I don't think we helped ourselves in any way. We had a great relationship with Africa because of our leadership in the Ethiopian famine, because of our leadership on Mandela, because of Canada was the first G7 nation to propose and implement a policy of the effacement de la dette africaine, which was the elimination of the erasing of African debt on ODA. This was a big deal for them in 1987, 1988. So we had a leadership role and we played it very actively, and that redounded to our benefit, because once you have 50 or so African states behind you, then when you go to the United Nations or you go elsewhere, you got more in the Commonwealth and then more in the G7, you're standing on a pretty solid foundation as a Canadian leader. But if you start to allow these things to erode, then all of a sudden your position becomes more fragile. So Canada and its future and its leadership depends on active multilateralism. And that involves engaging the Department of Global Affairs in our activities, funding it properly. Look, I'll give you two instances. When I was, the 9 years I was prime minister, the United Nations had 16 peacekeeping missions around the world. Canada participated in all 16. At one point, we had 80,000 people over a period of time active in peacekeeping. When I left office in 1993, there was still 3,700 peacekeepers on our payroll around the world. This morning, I think there were 150 in Mali. That's it. But this was a Canadian creation. Mike Pearson created this this idea. And for it to be effective, it has to be given wind and authority and sustenance by the mother country, and that's us. The other thing, for example, is Mike Pearson also, in his famous study, argued that 0.7% of GDP should go to foreign aid. We boosted it to ours to 0.5%. We weren't at 0.7%, but we were at 0.5%, and it's gone steadily downhill since. We're somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.2%. And in NATO, the last time we met the 2% obligation to fund NATO was when I was prime minister, which was now 30 years ago. And now we're way the hell down. All subsequent governments have reduced their commitments to NATO and to defense, as a result of which we don't have the clout we used to have at NATO for obvious reasons. So I think we have a lot to, you know, we have to reflect on where we want to be and how we get there. You know, John Manley, to sum all of this up, Colin, John Manley, who was the Liberal foreign minister at the time, made a very important statement. He said, you know, Canadians can talk a lot about things, but when you're at a conference and the bill comes around, Canada gets up and goes to the washroom.
Yes, I think that says it all. And I guess you've also, in a sense, answered my next question, is that how does Canada leverage its influence? And you've said through multilateralism, but that implies obligations and willingness to contribute and the kind of activist outreach. But also taking out the wallet.
Well, exactly. Like, you know, Denmark is at, what, 1% of GDP in foreign aid. The UK is way up there, very close to 0.7%.
No, they're at 2%, I think, and they're at 0.7%. Exactly. They manage it.
You know, so and they do it. Why the hell can't we? Well, because we're spending a lot of money in other, because this doesn't appear to be, have the importance it once had. But I wish Canadian leadership would realize that this is key. As Manley said, this is key to the respect and dignity Canada had around the world. We lived up to our obligations. Hell, when Stephen Lewis was my ambassador to the United Nations and Jesse Helms was cutting off 25% of the American contribution of the UN, I met with Stephen and I told him that every year, and I met with the Secretary General of the United Nations, and I said that every year Canada would prepay its obligations. We were the sixth largest contributor, financial contributor to the United Nations, that Canada would prepay its obligations on the 1st of January every year. And that was done. That became Canadian policy. You know, that the Secretary General of the United Nations shouldn't be going around like a mendicant with a tin cup in his hand. And we helped avoid that kind of thing with the enormous American cutbacks. As, for example, the Americans are just done with the WHO, the World Health Organization. So this is a position where, place where Canada can use its resources and its influence and its vision of the world to benefit our country and to benefit the world.
And the relationships that, in a sense, only leaders can develop and then cultivate to make things happen, as you did.
Exactly. It can't be done without that personal interconnection. Just can't be done. The world is too complicated. And, you know, you can't do this by, you can't do foreign policy at that level by email.
A final question before I ask you what you're reading. We're a federation of provinces and territories. How does that affect foreign policy making?
Well, not really. You know, you have to be conscious, for example, in the trade negotiations, because a lot of the trade decisions require provincial, because of our constitutional provisions, require provincial authorization to implement them. And so there's a lot of consultation should go on. And when we created La Francophonie with François Mitterrand and France, well, you know, there's a lot of consultation with Ontario and Quebec and New Brunswick being Canada's only officially bilingual province. So that kind of consultation is important and vital. But generally speaking, this internationally, Canada asserts its international authority and its sovereignty through its international actions in international fora of all kinds. The Prime Minister speaks for Canada, period.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Let me ask you now, always a popular part of these podcasts, what are you reading these days?
Well, I've just finished reading Eric Larson's great new book on Churchill, The Splendid and the Vile, and, which is, you know, the year in his life of the Blitz and what a fabulous leader he was. And in spite of his personal challenges and problems, the greatest of all times, I believe. And I had begun Beverly McLaughlin's excellent autobiography, and I had to set it aside. Something had come up urgently, and I'm just finishing it off now. It's a great book, and Beverly McLaughlin has had a great life. I'm particularly interested in it because I had given her first major appointment as Chief Justice of British Columbia, and then I tracked her down, as she recounts in her book, in Australia to appoint her to the Supreme Court of Canada, because I thought that we needed strong, outstanding women throughout the judiciary, and she was a leader. And she went on, as you know, to become Chief Justice and one of the most important in Canadian history. And so I'm finishing Beverly's book. And my old friend, Serge Savard of the Montreal Canadiens, who's now a very successful business guy in Montreal, put out his memoirs. And I took it with me. And right at the beginning of when the bottom fell out on the virus, I had it with me and I read that too. So pretty eclectic these days.
No, that's very good. Serge Savard, Beverly McLaughlin, and Eric Larson. Now, what about yourself? Are you thinking of doing something about your post-prime ministerial career?
Yes, I am.
Something to add to the memoir?
Yeah, I'm working on that, and I have something done, but it's far from ready for release. But I enjoy it. I like writing. I'm doing something right. In fact, I have it right in front of me. I'm doing something on that now, and but bits and pieces, you know, I'll try and pull it together. I better before I kick the bucket. So,
well, I encourage you to do it because Mr. Kretschamp put out a book recently of basically anecdotes and recollections of people, and I think it's a very effective form of getting messages across, and because it very much sounds his voice. I would encourage you to do the same, because I think you'll find a readership, and it's certainly something that we'll promote here on the Global Exchange.
Well, thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
And so thank you, Colin, for this. I hope we met your high standards.
No, you did indeed. So thank you again. And let me just tell listeners, we are joined today by the Right Honorable Brian Mulroney, former Prime Minister of Canada. Remember, you can find the CJA Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. That's where you'll see the references to Mr. Mulroney's book picks. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Jay Rankin and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.